Hello, and welcome to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne on 88.5 KRFY Community Radio for North Idaho. I am Dr. Joanne, and I hope you'll enjoy the medical topics that I have chosen to present at 8 a.m. the first Monday of every month and rebroadcast on the third Monday. And if you enjoy podcasts, you can listen to a podcast of the show at krfy.org and select the podcast tab. I'm very excited to have Rebecca Clowey, RDLD, here in the studio with me to discuss National Nutrition Month. Rebecca, tell us about your training and your job experience.
Hi, Joanne. Thank you for having me on today. It's always fun. It's always a pleasure to be here. So I am a registered dietitian. We can also say a registered dietitian nutritionist. The LD just means that I'm licensed, and I am in Idaho and Washington. So those are the two states that I practice in. So a little bit about our training. Dietitian is a master's level program that is very science heavy. And so we go and we study all kinds of things from chemistry to anatomy and physiology, mathematics, and other things that let us be able to learn about the human body and then apply nutritional sciences to the prevention of disease and the helping of disease.
Wonderful. And Susie Perez is also here in the studio to help me with this show and present it to our listening audience. Welcome, Susie.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Dr. Joanne. But I wanted the listeners to know a little bit about you. You, as the host of this wonderful show, Dr. Joanne is a longtime KRFY volunteer, previously hosting segments of Otto's Eclectic Music Mix, and is now, as we know, hosting Medical Musing the first and third Monday of the month at 8 a.m. Dr. Joanne is a retired pediatrician who has lived in Sandpoint since 2010. She previously worked in a pediatric practice in Columbus, Ohio for over 30 years and then covered at Sandpoint Pediatrics. As the media spokesperson for the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, she contributed to print, online media, radio, and television. Dr. Joanne is the mother of four adult children, and we are fortunate to have Medical Musing as part of our Monday morning programming.
Thank you, Susie. We're going to be discussing National Nutrition Month, as I like to feature a medical designation for each month. The emphasis on national nutrition as a topic to promote more thoroughly began as a week in 1973 and was extended to a month-long celebration in 1990. The Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics wanted to feature the pivotal role of nutrition in our daily lives. So therefore, this month and every day, we need to promote nutritional knowledge while helping the public to make informed food choices and develop healthy eating habits. So tell us, Rebecca, what is good nutrition? There's been the progression since I was in practice or maybe even a teenager from the pyramid, the plate, to the current recommendations. So what's different? What's really the same? I know meat and whole grains and full fat suddenly has been added back. So let's discuss a little bit the changes from in all these recommendations.
Okay, sure. So the Dietary Guidelines for Americans has been around a long time. It's something that is updated every fourth year, and it's meant to guide the public to making healthful nutritional choices. So our goal in healthy nutrition is to have people with health that goes along with happy and good lives, and to prevent disease, because disease is a burden, of course, on the nation. And so never mind the individual person, right? You know, it's interesting because there was a lot of anticipation leading up to this latest dietary guidelines. However, not a lot has actually shifted. You mentioned that there seems to be more of a focus on certain things, including maybe more full fat things. But ultimately, the recommendations underlying things such as saturated fat remain the same as they have been. So it is recommended that in the case of saturated fat, for example, which is a type of fat that we associate with cardiac health and keeping that amount low, it stays at about recommended of 10% from 10% of calories coming from saturated fat. So if you break that down, that comes to around 20, 22 grams per day, which is in fact less than 2 tablespoons. So I don't know about you, but if I have butter on my toast, I get 2 tablespoons right there, and that's the end of my saturated fat for the day, right? That hasn't actually changed. I think that the most exciting thing about the latest dietary guidelines is that we do want to get the attention of Americans in terms of the differences between whole foods and processed foods. And the current dietary guidelines gives a little bit of a push to the whole foods by calling these real foods, right? And that's a term that has been around for a long time, the differentiation between real, whole, natural foods and processed foods. And what is a processed food? Well, anything that's got a brand name on it has got to be processed. So choosing from chiefly things that are unbranded and unprocessed is going to be the best possibility for health.
It's so interesting because we do hear the same information, but as you said, the goals are similar. It's to encourage the public to make healthy choices, and they may have to make small changes initially because you can't make a huge change. And that was even one of the diets at one time, like change one was one of the, I remember a friend who gets Reader's Digest decided that they would do that, and it was like, add yogurt to your diet. So they added yogurt to their diet. And again, as you said, recommending plain meat and chicken and fish and not things that are in a box that are, you know, could have additives or preservatives or other things. And walking, I mean, we always talk about some kind of exercise. If you can't walk, you can maybe do chair yoga. Just do something.
Absolutely.
Basically.
Yeah.
It's so interesting to me when I would go to the athletic center here in January, the classes were always full because it was the New Year's resolution. And throughout the month, the class would get, you know, smaller and smaller and smaller. But the basic thing, I think, is to, for everyone to make a commitment to doing, you know, something to balance your calories with activities. And it's interesting to me, too, sometimes prescriptions, recommendations, like don't eat meat. Well, then if you don't eat any meat at all and you're not specifically looking for the good parts of being a vegetarian or a vegan, you don't get iron or you don't get this. So it's like perhaps what, you know, we really mean a lot of times is if you eat meat every day, twice a day, then eat meat twice a week, you know, something that's decreasing but not necessarily eliminating something, because sometimes people eliminate things and then they end up losing certain nutrients.
Sure, and something that I talk about a great deal. I mean, how do you feel in any area of your life when you're asked to eliminate something that you like, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to push back against that. That's not something that I enjoy. I don't like giving up things that I like. I reinforce very, very much the idea of putting in more of things, increasing things that we like, but also that are good for us, and learning to like new things. Having a wide variety of foods is paramount. So anytime that we see out in the public a dietary pattern that is more restrictive than not, more restrictive than open, that's kind of a signal, actually, of usually of some kind of a problem, right? Mm-hmm. So one thing that we do know is that virtually any dietary pattern, if it's not a food fad, virtually any dietary pattern that people enjoy and would like to pursue, that can be written as a healthy pattern of eating. It's not actually terribly difficult to find health in virtually any dietary pattern. So there needn't be something that is restrictive or pushing one way or another or eliminating food groups. In fact, the elimination of food groups is a red flag.
Yeah. Basically, it's the processed, and then we've come to ultra-processed foods. It's always interesting to me when I think of years and years ago, 1,000 years ago, 300 years ago, people went out in the morning and they caught their fish or they killed their meat and they ate almost the entire body of something. And they, you know, grew their crops. They grew the fruits and the vegetables. And then somewhere in the 1800s, we learned how to make tin cans. And then everything got in a tin can. And when I was a child, you know, the peas were olive green and the green beans were olive green and they were out of a can. And then they decided, oh, frozen foods were better. So then they froze the foods. And now we're back to natural, real food that you grow yourself. So
When one thing you mentioned, the whole foods compared to processed foods, and you mentioned that if a food has a brand name, it's probably processed. Also in the grocery stores, when you're walking around, the edges of the store seem to have the more whole foods, the less processed foods, such as the vegetables over on the right. I'm thinking of a store here in Sandpoint. And then the dairy and the meat on the back side, but in the middle is the more processed foods. And, you know, of the trends, as you say, and you're talking about, where do people go to find out? It can be very dangerous. Well, I don't want to use the word dangerous, but daunting, because there are so many trends. And my doctor says, only go to Cleveland Clinic or Mayo Clinic to find out what, you know, is next, because they do talk about that stuff.
Yeah, that's very good. In fact, you're leading into one of the things I was going to ask Rebecca. In Columbus, we have a group called Local Matters, and one of their classes is how to shop in the grocery store. So I don't know if you've ever done that, but it is, as you said, shop the perimeter, because the perimeter has the whole food, the real food. And, you know, that's basically a class that in some organizations will actually take you on a shopping trip and show you. And even, now I hate to admit this, but when I need carrots, I sometimes buy full long carrots, but sometimes I buy the little ones. And of course they teach people, because they're teaching people from all economic levels, that you don't need a machine to cut your carrots into those little dudes. You can buy the whole carrot and peel them. But I mean, that's even part of a nutrition class some places. So how do you teach people, Rebecca, what is good nutrition?
Yeah, you bring up the grocery store tour, and I really love a good grocery store tour. You know, there are a lot of foods in the grocery store, and yes, the perimeter tends to be where there's a lot of whole foods, because you have your produce section, but then you also have your coolers, right, and things like our freezer section. And, you know, always being careful not to demonize any one thing, but to know that we have a lot of availability of good food. Certainly frozen foods and anything that is canned, it makes food available to the American public all year round. And that's for how we have better nutrition than we've ever had before at our fingertips if we choose it. So definitely things like frozen foods are an important part of a healthy diet because they're convenient as well as fresh, you know.
So some people really need that convenience, but you maybe don't need to do the frozen peas that have the butter sauce on them or something like that. So the plain frozen peas or the plain, you know.
No, sure. Always reading about additives. That's one of the primary things that I teach, is just how to get people off of the front of package where all the pretty pictures are, and the food claims that may or may not be heavily substantiated, and get them onto the back where the food label is. That has to be uniform from food to food, no matter what it is. If it's a packaged food, it's got to have a food label on it. And then that's how we can keep track of things like sodium and saturated fat, fat overall, and added sugar.
Nice. Well, now I wonder, as we've talked about the many diets and Susie talking about, you know, finding your expert source that you trust, or that your doctor or your therapist or whoever you're talking to or your dietitian is telling you is a good expert source instead of just random going to the internet. Even the basics have certain detractors. We've heard now about seed oils and, you know, seed oils versus now people are going back to beef tallow. And I mean, again, back to my 1,000 years ago, I mean, it was animal fat is what came off the animal that helped people cook their food. So
we called that lard.
Yeah. So can you tell us anything about all these new recommendations for fat and seed oils and...
Well, I think an important thing to remember is, whether it comes off of an animal or it comes out of a plant, the very first thing that we do if we have fat by itself is we have processed it. So there is a difference between eating a piece of fresh chicken and it's got fat in it, then rendering out the fat and then adding that to various foods that don't naturally have that. There's a difference between a heavily processed olive oil and a lightly processed one. And so I think remembering that some of these separated fats are processed, and then paying attention to what those are. Not much has changed, and certainly not in the guidelines. We're not talking about differences in the recommendations for saturated fat. As I said earlier, that's still no more than 10%. And for heart health, we say 7%. If somebody's a heart patient, a cardiac patient, which is partly where I work, we say 7% of calories in the diet coming from saturated fat. Based on a 2,000 calorie diet, and I don't eat quite that in a day, that's only a tablespoon and a half of fat.
So you can give them concrete recommendations, because if I would talk to someone and say 7% of your diet, they'd like maybe be out somewhere in outer space. So, or trying, you know, to do the math or maybe, but so giving them a recommendation of a teaspoon, a tablespoon, that certainly helps too. What about though, the, like for a while, coconut oil was the trend and then avocado oil was the trend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, when I was first married, I probably cooked with more canola oil or whatever. And now that's in the back of my refrigerator because it happens to be in like a cake that I like to make. Or sometimes I always make my salad dressing with olive oil. And the other day, someone gave me a recipe and said, this salad's really great. And it was like, maybe it would have tasted better with canola oil rather than olive oil. It just didn't quite get the zip that the other person said this salad had. So maybe I had overwhelmed it with olive oil or something. So you basically balance it again. We're talking about, you know, like I said, my canola oil is in the back of the refrigerator. I only use it for one or two things, probably much less than I did when I first was married. My other thing when I was first married, it was interesting and the food was really very good, but think of the 70s and 80s and how much we cooked with prepared soup. And
cream of mushroom.
You know, cream of mushroom was on the
Jello
The cream of mushroom was on the pork chops. It was really easy. So I was working and I could line up the pork chops and put the mushroom soup on top. And then the babysitter could just put that in the oven for me and dinner was ready. Or chicken, there was the chicken rice, the tomato rice soup made a really good chicken dish. So we've kind of gotten away from some of that. And I think, again, getting away from additives, it's better to make your own little tomato sauce and put it on your chicken, if that's
sure. I definitely would never want to see home cooking and cooking from scratch. It's such a joy. Anyway, we have a connection with our food when we handle it and when we make things out of it and when we're busy in our own kitchen and when we get our children involved in that. There's something that's just so important. I don't know about you, Joanne, but I have a garden, and to see things come up from little and then eat them myself is really precious. And we wouldn't want to lose that as a culture, right? Yeah. We do want to keep certain things. We want to stay close to our food.
One of the things you just mentioned, a garden. In our school district, they have gardens. Each school has a garden. And just for a child to see a carrot, we'll say, come up from a seed really brings a sense of understanding, where does my food come from? And so maybe it's just a little bit of information that they can kind of take into themselves and influence their future.
Sure. And that's an evidence-based technique. It's shown that especially when children have a connection from dirt to table with their own food and they participate in all aspects of it, you know what? They get excited about it. They get proud of it. They want to eat it and they want to share it, right? So a lot of times we see children in these settings actually taking good nutrition information back into the homes. It's really fascinating to watch.
That'd be interesting. Like, no, Mom, I want to eat fresh green beans and not the canned. Not those that are olive green, as I said.
And I think at the end of the season, when the children come back to school, they harvest the food and then make a beautiful lunch or something like that. And fresh carrots or fresh potatoes over canned.
Oh, they're wonderful. Difference. You know how fresh that tastes, how delicious that is, right? Farmers markets are beautiful.
Children learn through experience a lot.
For sure.
So do you have actual cooking classes and with a didactic portion to them in
your
work?
Yeah, we do. I am doing, I do a cooking class every single Thursday. So I'm putting on about 50 a year in our cardiac rehab. And I do that all day long on Thursday. The focus there, because it is cardiac rehab with people that have come back from serious cardiac events, the focus there is going to be heart health, right? But more than just talking about heart health, we want people to understand how to cook food at home, how to handle their food, how to choose their food at the grocery store, read labels, know what their targets are for certain kinds of fat and for sodium and added sugars, and then be able to implement that and choose food that belongs to them that's going to help them.
Very interesting. One thing I didn't maybe put on you, the thought that I was going to talk about, so I hope this isn't a, I'm not sending you a curveball, but interesting in when you're online, you know, the doctor comes on and says, oatmeal is not good for you. And then, you know, the majority, again, 75% of what you read is, you know, oatmeal is great. So is oatmeal good or bad for you? And does it matter if you eat regular or quick cook, steel cut? It, or is it the additives in the individual packets, or is it the actual digestibility of the oats themselves?
Oh, my goodness. You brought up about 100 things. Yeah, thank you for that curveball. Yeah.
She didn't mention glycinates, meaning organic or not organic.
Yeah, and we can go there with a lot of different things. I mean, I think remembering that oat is a whole grain and it's a groat, right? So if you actually buy oat groats, and I have them at my house myself, they just look like rice. They look like brown rice, right? And you can cook them as such. I think it's very important not to take any individual food and put what we call the health halo on it or demonize it. I think these polarities are not helpful for us. Certainly, we know that oat has, with the beta glycans that it has in it, it has the ability to usher cholesterols out of the body. And a lot of Americans have cholesterol problems where they're carrying too much fat that is circulating in their bloodstreams. And so we know that oat can be a useful food. Is that all we're supposed to eat? Of course not, you know. Maybe it makes a difference if we cover it with brown sugar and butter, or if we cover it with blueberries. But to demonize any food is not helpful. To put a halo on any food is not helpful, right? There are no magic foods, but fresh food is kind of magical, actually.
I love that. That's why I, you know, love talking to people. And maybe we shouldn't be, you know, having our, you know, one way, but I think that's kind of the way I've lived my life and our practice too, is to be balanced and to be realistic and to, you know, have some common sense. So that's great. You don't eliminate something just because some doctor on a podcast that I don't listen to, because they don't give you the answer until the very, very, very end of 10 or 15 minutes. It's like, I don't know that I really need to listen to you. So anyways, so again, regular whole oats are probably better than the packaged ones, because the packaged ones have additives.
If it has added sugar in it, we want to be very cautious about that. Yeah, for sure.
So use the basically the regular containers and cook it yourself.
And it's very easy. When I cook rolled oats, and I do it pretty frequently at work, I put it in the microwave because it's fast and easy.
Yeah, that big pot of this stuff. And I like mine a little crisper than some people, you know, not quite the mush kind of stuff. So, yeah. So with the microwave, you can make it the consistency that, that you really
You're talking about people looking out. There is such an enormous amount of information out there, and not all of it is factual, right? And so who do we look for? And I want to remind people that actually looking to one's own body is the best way to know if what you're doing currently is helping you or not. How is your health? How do you feel? How is your energy? And that will kind of let you know if what you've been doing for the last few years is helping you or not. And then looking maybe for professional guidance to help you tweak that if that's what you feel like is necessary.
What are the major diagnoses of the clients that you're working with?
Oh, boy. That's pretty easy, because the main diagnosis of most people in America are going to end up with heart disease. That's the biggie. That is our number one killer. It continues to be. And then, of course, the body is a system. We're not just a heart, or we're not just a bloodstream or a circulatory system. And so we have things that tend to come in packages. So heart disease, diabetes is a huge one. And of course, type 2, which is one that comes on in the body from lifestyle chiefly. That's a really big one. I see a lot of diabetes. I see a lot of people who come in and want to focus on some weight loss potentially, because maybe they have problems with their joints, their knees, their feet, their ankles, and they would like to help themselves in that way. Those are top three very common problems people have.
Well, that leads right into our just a little conversation about obesity rates that keep rising despite all of the information we have available. When I think of my childhood, we certainly ate more of what we now call real food, but we also were so excited when we saw Hostess Twinkies and Ho-Hos, and I mean, those were processed foods. But it seemed like, you know, because we ran around outside, we played all the time, we didn't come in till dark, we rode our bikes everywhere, our culture was just that much different. And so, you know, I know that's a completely different discussion about children and what they're doing now, but I think all of this and an increase in processed foods, I mean, the Pringles came in and, you know, all the different kinds of chips that aren't even real. And then the chip manufacturers now kind of went, oh, well, we're lower fat or we're lower salt. So perhaps they're trying. Susie?
I heard you mention heart is a big issue for health and diabetes. If folks knew when they first are diagnosed with diabetes that they could control it differently by changing their lifestyle. As mm-hmm. you said, it's a lifestyle thing. But how, because 10 years after they start taking insulin and have problems, they go, oh, I wish I had known. So how can you get the word out to people that it, you still have a road to hoe in front of you with health, but you can minimize it and make it better for your life if you knew ahead of time that you can make changes.
Sure, sure. And I think some of the conversations around health are important. There is a wide variety of differences in how people approach their own health. And when I was first going to school to be a dietitian, and I thought I had ideas about if people know this information, they will run with it. They will love it and adore it as much as I do. And unfortunately, that's not true. Some people get very tired and burned out on things like that. And sometimes people make the choice to go down a certain health path and say, I choose the medication path. And they actively choose it. Some people say, no, I want a lifestyle path, and they actively choose it. And there's just a difference in how people like to approach various things, right? So what I would like to see happen in the medical community is for those conversations to just begin a little earlier. So if somebody has a diagnosis or a label, if you will, from their doctor of, say, pre-diabetes, that is not something that a doctor is going to treat. They might talk about it, but we don't whip out the insulin to treat pre-diabetes. That's not what we do. But at that point, it is so much easier for me to work with somebody with lifestyle to prevent it from developing into full-blown diabetes. And so I would love at that point when doctors screen people in and see a pre-diabetic level or they see the level of potential towards diabetes rising year over year, the A1C is going up. I'd love to have those dietitian referrals because what we have going on at where I work, I'm working the nutrition side. I have my colleagues that are working the fitness side, and putting those two things together is formidable. It will change your life forever if you nail nutrition and fitness.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So really what we're saying is that doctors or nurse practitioners or PAs should make their referrals earlier to a dietitian, or at least we always had handouts. Now, whether the handouts ended up on the driveway, you know, instead of in the car, but we always gave a handout on, you know, this is, you know, we really should start looking at your diet, and here are some suggestions, and the next step would be seeing a dietitian. So identifying the problem and then making referrals a little earlier can certainly be helpful. It's interesting, the U.S. has the 18th highest obesity rate. We always hear that we are the most obese, but we're the most obese of developed countries. And so the Pacific Island nations, St. Kitts and Nevis and St. Lucia, where people go on vacation, and Egypt have much higher rates. And of course, it varies state by state. And it's interesting, Idaho is the 8th lowest. And I think other low states like California, Colorado, and Florida, they have wonderful weather, but they also have active people. So again, it's that activity. It's not that we have no obesity, because obviously we do, but are overweight people. But people who are in areas where they can be active tend to be a little bit better off on the obesity scale. I need to take a little break. You are listening to 88.5 KRFY Community Radio for North Idaho. We do know that chronic illness, as we've talked about, such as diabetes and heart disease, are associated with the increased weight. So everything's very circular, basically. And medical spending is high, and medical spending for chronic diseases is actually one of the major drivers of this of high spending. U.S. healthcare is at 18% of our GDP. Now, again, people understand that, but with the majority spent on chronic diseases. So people like Rebecca are doing a great job trying to help people understand their illnesses and then make a lifestyle change. So let's talk about all these diets. I can remember when I was a kid, I had heard about the grapefruit diet. And I did it in the summer because I wanted to be thinner for, you know, the next school year. My mother would always be upset because grapefruits were not really in season in the summer. But the grapefruit diet was primarily protein and grapefruit. So you could eat steak, you could eat this, you could eat that, tuna fish, things that had protein and grapefruit. And an egg for breakfast. I'm not sure what lunch was, a small salad. Dinner was steak and, you know, something like that, protein. And you could have a small bit of ice cream. And so that was sort of the diet that I kind of got hooked on. But I don't know that I really planned it for so long. Then, of course, my friends got onto South Beach and everyone had lettuce wraps and less carbohydrate and Atkins and then other ones that changed you into ketosis. And for the public, ketosis means when you're burning your fat and your glucose products, so you don't end up, but you're not supplying any, or you're supplying less carbohydrates. So I went through the hundreds of fad diets that are listed, or not all fad, but hundreds of diets on the internet, I was fascinated because there actually is a fruitarian diet. And we always laughed because that was in Notting Hill, if you've watched the movie Notting Hill, and the one girl at the table goes, "Well, I'm a fruitarian." And I didn't really realize that there was a disease listed on the internet as a fruitarian. So tell us a little bit what your ideas are. Can we put diets into good and bad diets, or perhaps just fad diets?
I really don't want to categorize things into good and bad. Because that implies sort of a morality of surrounding food that people tend to take on as coloring themselves. And that's not really where we want to go about it. So I think that you kind of said it all, Joanne, when you said fad diet, right? A fad diet is something that's popular now for a while, for a reason. And those aren't always what people find popular to do or fun to do or interesting to do isn't always in their best interest health-wise. But you know what? Fad diets get our attention. And when I'm working with somebody to change their lifestyle for the better using nutrition and using exercise, what I really want is to get them to look at their lifestyle. What am I doing now? And people who pay attention to their diet tend to change it. Mm-hmm. And people who tend to change it tend to change it for the better with just a very little bit of direction. So what I would say is if we find anything that gets my attention now, then do that. And in a sense of, is it healthful? That's an important criteria, but also focusing on focusing on my food at all tends to get us to go down a healthier track.
Mm-hmm. When I was looking at the DASH diet and the especially the DASH diet, looked very similar actually to the plate or to the recommendations of the new pyramid, mm-hmm. basically.
And DASH diet's not a fad diet. No, I want to put that out there.
Yeah,
right?
Definitely. That's mm-hmm. one of the medically based mm-hmm.
it's a core,
diets.
Core diet, yep.
So tell us a little bit about DASH and the Mediterranean diet, because I think those probably, in my mind, are two of the healthier ones.
Yeah, and those are very similar. I think if you put those side by side, we're going to see mostly similarities there. The DASH diet was something that was put in place, again, to get people's attention to what do I do if I need to help my heart, lower my blood pressure, and so on. And so DASH, of course, stands for Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension. If you follow the DASH diet, your blood pressure will go down. It's a very effective diet. It gets us to get our sodium under control, to set targets for ourselves, because the sodium target varies from person to person. And then again, just as we keep hearing, and we hear also in the Mediterranean diet, to focus on fresh, healthy foods and those lightly processed foods that are convenient to us but still healthy.
So those are both kind of a compilation or a recommendation of really healthy eating. I know when we communicated before, you said some recipes you see that under the Mediterranean aren't always so Mediterranean. Do you have more comments about that?
Oh, well, you know, we do have one of the popular things to do out there is to be what we call a social media influencer, right? But of course, there's nothing new under the sun. And so if you're going to be on social media, or if you're going to be a food blogger or write recipes, you're trying to come up with new takes on things. And so I think if somebody wants to follow the Mediterranean diet or the DASH diet, either working with a dietitian on that or looking up reputable sources on the internet that are going to guide us towards the specific criteria for implementing a Mediterranean diet or the DASH diet, I think that's important. So, for example, we make jokes about it, of course, but the Mediterranean diet allows for red wine and olive oil, but those aren't supposed to be the main components of that diet, right? As much as we like those things. So keeping the various components of these diets in their place, and certainly any healthful diet would guide us towards eating mostly, a large amount of vegetables that does have a healthy place emphasis.
Yeah. It's interesting, when I remember friends were on South Beach and I looked it up, it's like, I can't eat fruit? And so whether that's the beginning, the first week or two, or the first month or so, it was like, fruit has sugar in it and that's bad. It's like, but fruit is, natural and good for you. And so again, your idea that you don't tell people you can't eat this or that, because that makes them either want it more or just gets them so unbalanced that, mm-hmm. that it's not really a good idea.
And certainly fruit is not a disease causer, so I never steer people away from fruit. Most people eat much less than they should.
Yeah. Certainly not the canned fruit with syrup, as opposed to the canned fruit with
Water.
Yeah, no. Just water. But Susie, what did you
want to say? Well, I was thinking in talking about some of this that if there was classes in schools, maybe that's home ec, I don't know, learning about nutrition, but also, as we get older, we're sitting here, I found out about sarcopenia and that there's three things you can do for it. But the bottom line, it's more protein, not strictly protein, a balanced diet. Again, I love that thought, exercise and resistance training, but it only works if you do it. And so people can get a lot of information about what they can do to overcome a disease like diabetes, not overcome it, but, slow it down or to manage it better, but you still have to do it. So where does the motivation, when I exercise, I always, in my mind, I'm saying, I have no choice. I want to be stronger. I want to stay on my feet as an older person walking through the world. Mm-hmm. And so there's that motivation to actually do it, find out about it. But the good news is the internet has the good, the bad, and the misinformed. So that's just what I wanted to say. So how do we motivate people? I'm probably getting off subject here a little bit, but
it's makes some sense. Maybe one of the questions then would be how clients are coming back. What's the rate of, people dropping out of your classes or the group at in cardiac rehab.
Mm-hmm. Actually, what the interesting thing is that the place where people tend to drop out, if you will, of cardiac rehab is at the point of referral. So they're given the referral by their doctor, and then they make a choice. They say, I'm going to make that call to that cardiac rehab, or I'm not. And then once they make the call and we tell them about the program, people either come in or they don't. And it's about 60-40, right? Mm-hmm. But once people get in our cardiac rehab, the dropout rate is extremely low. People really tend to plug into that. Those are the people who want to change their health for the better. And what's really wonderful is there are a lot of people that we have that once they've gone through our cardiac rehab program, they migrate over to our regular lifestyle exercise program. And we love to see people coming from cardiac and keeping that whole thing going there.
That's great. That's kind of what I would talk about, the healthy kind of pyramid scheme, or tell your friends, too. So, you know, they have a good experience with you, and then they're talking to a friend who either has been diagnosed with high blood pressure or has had, you know, a mild myocardial infarction, has perhaps one stent put in, and they tell them, and so their doctor may not say so. Do you need a doctor's prescription to come, or can you just make a call yourself?
You do need a doctor's referral to come to cardiac rehab, but you can also ask them for that. So if you're a patient who sees a cardiologist and you've had something go on, just ask for it, you know, and most doctors are extremely happy when their patients take that level of proactivity.
Good. That's wonderful. One other thing, and then we'll get on, I think, to the GLP and a little bit more about type 2 diabetes. But what are your recommendations for vegans and vegetarians? I've always, you know, worried sometimes when patients, the family is a vegan or vegetarian, and the children, I just want to be sure that they get enough protein and they get enough iron, you know. Do children eventually go, I can't eat another bean or whatever, basically.
Or tofu.
So, yeah. And to get their vitamins. I mean, certainly you can, they're 10 million, you know, if you go to the grocery store or the pharmacy, vitamins are galore, but they need to be absorbed and not come out in your urine, too. So tell me what you tell people who want to be on a vegan or a vegetarian diet.
Sure, I say yay. That's what I say. And most people who come to me to talk about these things, they already are doing this lifestyle, right? We know that we see much lower levels of disease in those populations. So there are a few things that we look out for when somebody is on a vegetarian or a vegan diet. And remember, a vegetarian diet is things like being pescatarian. That falls under the heading of vegetarian. And so there are, you're vegan, which is no animal products, you're vegetarian, which is some level of animal product, and you make your choices, or you're omnivorous, right? So most of the United States is omnivorous. Most of our disease states are in the omnivorous population. There it is, right? So the way that I said before, that a dietary pattern of choice can be put together as a healthful one, one that is health-promoting, or any dietary pattern can be put together as a disease-promoting mm-hmm. pattern. So I do like to look out in my vegetarian and vegan populations for vitamin D and B12. Those are cheap and easy to get. They are so easy to get in a supplement. You get down at the Costco, the big bottles of this stuff for very cheap money. But protein is actually ubiquitous. It is everywhere, because if the thing has been alive, whether it's a plant or an animal, it's full of protein. And I have never actually seen anybody with protein deficiency in my practice.
That's wonderful. What about iron deficiency, though?
Not so much. I don't see too much of that. Usually somebody that's severely iron deficient, most of the people that I see with that, they have some kind of state, like some type of anemia or not found bleeding that leads to those problems.
And what about milk versus milk substitutes and soy and oat? And nut, you know, all the different nut milks.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. So certain people in our population can't have dairy product because they don't digest the lactose, so they're lactose intolerant. And so there are a lot of product out there now that can be very helpful and beneficial to those people. What I would recommend looking out for is product like that that is the minimum of ingredients in it. So try to look, if you're looking, for example, for a soy milk, look for one that has two ingredients, soybean, water, and then has a high level of protein in it. You're looking for something between 8 and 12 grams of protein always. And then also the fewer ingredients, we don't want that added sugar in there. And if you are going to use something like that, it can be beneficial to find something that's fortified, has some added nutrition in it that is helpful for people.
Yeah, that's great, because I know there are a lot of people that do develop lactose deficiency. It's interesting. Most people are born with the enzyme to digest milk, because that's kind of, it's sort of a, basically a way you find in embryology and then on into development, that when you need the lactose, you have the enzyme. And as we age, people lose the lactase enzyme, and it's more common in certain populations.
And speaking of lactase, I know that you can buy enzymes, digestive enzymes for lactate, yeah, and also gluten.
But one thing I'm seeing more and more is you don't even need to consume the enzyme anymore, because you can purchase product, including yogurt and certain types of milk, where they have just removed the lactose, yeah, right? And so that gives a wide variety of opportunities for a lot of people. My daughter is lactose intolerant, and so when she gets into lactose, she suffers, you know, for a while. But she was so excited to see a yogurt that doesn't have lactose in it. She says, oh, I can eat yogurt again. It's such a treat. Yeah.
And what about gluten? Because that is the big one. You go to a functional medicine person or something, they test you for that. And gluten can be difficult for people. And there's also a gluten enzyme. I forget what it is, but you can take a little pill.
Glutaminase?
Yeah, maybe.
But, you know, and then there's real gluten sensitivity versus celiac disease versus gluten sensitivity. Mm-hmm. So it's really important. At least I felt it was really important that mothers will challenge their child, because if you don't do any kind of challenge and you just label someone as gluten sensitive, then they have this whole lifestyle and they may not be. So, or having the test, there are tests for celiac disease. So going to, again, a reputable doctor and getting the tests so that you can rule out a true entity like celiac disease,
How do you challenge a child? Here's a little story. I worked in a kindergarten, and the little girl sat next to me during snack, and she said, I'm gluten and lactose intolerant. She's this little tiny thing and freckles all over her face, and it was kind of cute. The next year, she's in first grade, and she was eating something with gluten and dairy in it. And she said, I'm no longer lactose and gluten intolerant. And in a year, you know, it's just almost like it was a trend or a fad that parents said, well, she has a stomach ache, so maybe we'll do that.
Mm-hmm. You guys have opened a massive can of worms here.
Yeah, I know.
There's so much that we could talk about that. Yeah. Did you want to talk about that a little bit? The thing is that sometimes we can develop intolerances, and this is different from true allergy. These are always related to the protein, and gluten is an umbrella term for many, many different proteins. It is not one thing, and that's important to remember. But it is also true that people, you know, for example, somebody can have a severe illness, and it can upset their body, upset their gut, such that they suddenly do not tolerate certain things. Our aim is always, with some kind of intolerance, to bring that person back to full health, where those foods can be reintroduced, right? It's a dangerous thing, actually, to take away food after food after food until the person is stuck eating just a few things. That's a mismanaged diet. That's a problem.
Yeah. Back to balance.
Yeah, definitely. And years ago, two things. One is, yes, you can have like stomach flu, gastroenteritis, and then sort of lose the ability to digest milk or gluten or whatever, but it resumes. And probiotic and yogurt might be more, might actually be helpful. When we were in Europe, people talk about the cheese, and I've always told people too, whole cheese, real cheese, is often tolerated by some people who have some level of lactose intolerance, but it's that those American cheese slices, the processed cheese, that's mm-hmm. not. So real cheese, real yogurt, without a lot of added sugar, may be tolerated.
Real cheese and real yogurt yeah. are fermented products where that sugar is pre-digested. And so we let the bacteria do some work for us.
Yeah. So basically there are ways that people aren't always completely lactose intolerant. The other thing is you asked about how you challenge a child. The original way before we had blood tests for celiac disease was the child at 8 months, 10 months, whatever, 15 months was being introduced to products with gluten. They became ill. They could either have diarrhea. Some were even constipated. And the true thing was you sent them to a gastroenterologist. They did a biopsy. Then you take them off gluten products, they re-biopsy, and then you re-challenge. So that was three biopsies. Some parents didn't always like that, obviously.
Yeah, that's a difficult
and
procedure.
So, I mean, that was the true challenge for celiac disease. And when you said freckled girl, and I don't know if you said red hair, but I thought interesting because the Irish do have more celiac disease. So I thought maybe she was real, but I also had granddaughter and her friend who got into the I can't eat this, I can't eat that. And we went to a Mexican restaurant and she did have cheese on her quesadilla. But anyway, the entire way we drove to the restaurant, she was telling us she couldn't have lactose. But we only have a little bit of time left, but the GLP-1 drugs are something we wanted to talk a little bit about. They were initially developed to treat type 2 diabetes. Because initially So type 2 diabetes is non-insulin dependent by definition, and it's often associated with obesity, as we've talked about. Metformin was one of the original drugs, and some people did lose weight on metformin. And then as things progress, we got a better drug for treating type 2 diabetes. And now we have Ozempic and Wegovy and Mounjaro. And so tell us a little bit about patients that come in with GLP or how you work with them.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure. And that's becoming more and more common. I actually kind of like seeing patients that come in. I like seeing patients with the GLP-1 drugs. I like seeing them in my office. The reason for this is because, as I mentioned before, these people are paying attention to what they are eating. They are have made a connection between taking this medication, their diabetes, weight loss, and what they are trying to achieve with their bodies. I think since I have a moment to talk about this, I will say what is what I have seen as being the number one thing. Remember that taking GLP-1 drugs is not a magic pill. It isn't. It is not the silver bullet. It is an adjunct to getting some health improvements. And the number one thing that I see is people making the mistake that they take these medications and then they do not couple it with strong resistance exercise programming. These medications do cause some wasting of muscle, some loss of muscle, and the last thing we want is to lose a lot of weight, and a big part of that being our muscle mass, which is so important for health, for longevity, for strength, and for a good life. And so if people are not coupling a strong resistance training program with their GLP-1, that's a mistake that will have regrettable outcomes, unfortunately. So I'd love to see, when I get referrals, I love to see it when doctors give the prescription for the GLP-1, they give a referral to me, and they say also, hey, pop over to exercise and strength training.
They're new enough that perhaps we don't have enough information because a lot of things have to be followed long term. But do you see people can get off them? And I guess, again, if they're getting a lifestyle change that they truly believe in and want to continue to follow, then they'll do maybe okay. I mean, I guess we don't, again, have all that data off the medicine.
And we're starting to have a lot more. And there tend to be certain side effects associated with these drugs. And so we're seeing by some research, more than half the people that begin on them do not stay on them more than a year. Not everybody tolerates them. So, mm-hmm. You know, sometimes people also can be on them for 3, 4, 5, 6, 8 months at a time. They can achieve certain things. They can change lifestyle enough that it's become habitual. And then they can slowly fully get off of them if that's what they need, you know, if the side effects are too much, and still have a lot of benefit with what they've achieved.
Or they don't. We don't know quite yet, I guess, if they have to stay on them to maintain weight mm-hmm. loss. And again, it would be certainly combined with how faithful you are to your diet and to your exercise program.
Absolutely.
Susie.
Well, it's riveting. I think one of the things I just heard someone say, you get habituated to lifestyle changes, and the motivation is health, and health is wealth. It really is, especially as we get older. We understand that completely. So the good news is there's ways that you can change, and as you've mentioned, learn more and then do it.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You can't just take the medicine and not go to a program or not make changes yourself. So someone has to be involved in helping you get on a good diet and get into an exercise program. There has to be that motivation.
And the important thing there is there is no substitute for good nutrition and for moving the body, for exercise. And being consistent with these two things is paramount. These two things throughout the lifestyle, or sorry, throughout the lifespan bring good health.
All right. Is there anything we think we've missed?
Boy, we could have a whole nother show, I think.
No, I know. And like wheat belly.
I heard you say, ask your doctor for a referral. I think that sometimes you just have to ask. They're busy. Mm-hmm. They might not put two and two together, but a patient or person can ask for a referral to nutritional support.
Absolutely, 100%.
Well, and that's why this show, I think, is so important, because if we do, our listeners can, again, go out and tell their friends, too, that they've heard this show, and have you asked your doctor for this? You can't say, tell your doctor, but have you asked your doctor, perhaps, or you tell your doctor.
But advocate for yourself. Yeah, ask for what you think might be useful for you. You know yourself best.
Definitely. Well, sincere thank you to Rebecca Clowey, registered dietitian, for discussing National Nutrition Month. And thank you for listening. Please do remember that this is a medical information show. It does not substitute for discussing your concerns with your medical provider. If you missed any part of the program, catch the show at krfy.org under the podcast tab. I hope you'll join me on the first or third Monday of April. That's April 6th and April 20th, when I'll be discussing with Josh Barnes, licensed clinical social worker, Stress Awareness Month.
And we will rebroadcast this show on the 16th, or you can go to our website at krfy.org and listen to the podcast at your leisure.
Okay. Thank you so much, Susie, and thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.